From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at Michigan's slice of the new federal budget.
It restores a lot of money for restoring the Great Lakes. There's some money in there for defense projects that have been going on in Michigan. Head Start slots are restored at full funding. I mean, there's a lot in there that is going to help Michigan and a lot of other states.
Plus, a closer look at the business side of Detroit's music scene.
If you look at the music business as a share of total employment, we're certainly on the higher end of that spectrum.
And how archiving websites will give future scholars a clear look at our lives in 2013.
And these are cultural artifacts, you know, kind of the way we live now. And, you know, in essence, it's kind of a time capsule that future generations will be able to see, you know, what it was like to, you know, live in this day and age.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us on this cold Monday. Governor Rick Snyder delivered his fourth State of the State address last week. He touted a recovering economy and improving job growth. But Democrats were none too pleased with the speech. On today's program, we dive into what the governor said. We'll look at new proposed initiatives and find out what they could mean for you. And then from Motown to Madonna, Eminem to Kid Rock, the Detroit area was and continues to be a musical powerhouse. Now, one economic reporter is actually trying to figure out just how much all that's worth, monetarily speaking. We find out more later in the hour. But first, what a difference 3 months makes. After the knockdown, drag-out budget debacle that shut down the government in October, here we are in January. And perhaps prodded by the furious reaction of most Americans to last fall's budget showdown, last week saw both chambers of Congress quietly and meekly passing a $1 trillion federal budget deal that runs until September. Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler joins us now. Todd, you say this budget deal bodes well for Michigan?
Sure. I mean, at least at an early glance, it does. I mean, it restores a lot of money for restoring the Great Lakes. There's some money in there for defense projects that have been going on in Michigan. Head Start slots are restored at full funding. I mean, there's a lot in there that is going to help Michigan and a lot of other states.
So it seems that what I get the sense from what you've been writing about this is what Uncle Sam took away with sequester cuts, Uncle Sam's given back?
To a large degree, that's the case. Remember, when the sequester happened, it was the budget deal that was never supposed to happen. It was put into place as a hammer to make fractious parts of Congress come together to some kind of agreement. They never did. These across-the-board cuts went in, and really no one really liked them. The conservatives didn't like the cuts that were in there for the Defense Department. More progressives in Congress didn't like cuts to Head Start and things like that. But there was really very little room for an agreement to solve those things. This time around, like you said, in part perhaps because of the shutdown, they managed to come to some sort of agreement that while there would be cuts, they would be far more surgically imposed.
So let's kind of break down what some of the givebacks are. And you mentioned Head Start, and I know that has been the source of a lot of concern here in Michigan with the number of Head Start. We had lost more than 1,800 Head Start and early Head Start slots, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, there were about 1,800 that were lost in the state. You know, in some cases, other nonprofits were able to step up and try to help out to find slots for people. But it really did have an impact in Michigan. This does restore full funding to Head Start. It restores full funding to LIHEAP, the Low-Income Heating Energy Assistance Program, which a lot of people in Michigan use. I mean, it really does start to give money back to those areas where Democrats wanted to see fully funded. As I said, there are also places that help in Michigan, like auto suppliers and other suppliers who help with defense equipment for the M1 Abrams tank, the Stryker vehicle. Those are things that really do help in and around TACOM there in Warren. So there are some givebacks there. At the same time, overall, it doesn't give back everything that was taken away from the sequester, not by a long shot, but it does sort of put them on a path where they're actually doing budgeting. They're actually deciding where the money's going to be spent rather than having this sort of meat cleaver across the board cut routine.
One of the things you pointed out in your story for the Free Press was Michigan State University's Facility for Rare Isotopic Beams gets a whole $55 million, the full amount requested. What is that going to do?
Absolutely. I mean, it's and I'm no scientist, so but you know what I know that this is a research facility that MSU is counting on to draw in engineers and researchers from all over the world to really do this extraordinarily complicated advanced research. They've been working on it for years now. It sounds like this year they could really get the construction going if they got full funding. Senators Stabenow and Levin were able to get that as part of this deal to make sure this is fully funded, which is good news for Michigan.
Now, you point out there is money coming back, increased funding for the Army Corps of Engineers, which leads to the question, could this benefit the Great Lakes and how?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things here that Michiganders are probably going to be most happy about is that the Army Corps of Engineers gets a sizable chunk of funding. They should be able to do most of the maintenance projects that are hanging out there for Michigan and the Great Lakes harbors. Now, whether or not they get rid of the backlog, and it's a sizable one, I think that's very much something that's up in the air. But they should be able to move pretty forward ahead with these dredging projects. At the same time, there's fully funded $300 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. That's something that does projects all over the lakes to try to improve wetlands and fight runoff. There's a full funding for the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which helps rebuild sewer systems that are dumping, you know, too much waste into the water. So overall, that's good news for Michigan.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler as we look at the new federal budget deal. The House and Senate Appropriations quietly unveiled this bill that much less in the way of fireworks than we saw last fall when they tried to do that. Now, you do point out something that struck me, Todd, that Republicans slashed all funding for high-speed rail. First of all, why did the GOP lawmakers target high-speed rail?
Well, this has always been something that has been kind of a sticking in Republicans' craw. I mean, their idea about high-speed rail and a lot of sort of alternate infrastructure programs like this is that the market should pay for them. This is not something the government should be wholly in the business of funding or putting up funding streams that going forward are just going to cost more and more to keep these going. So the Republicans made a very clear point that while they were restoring some funding, there's some money for infrastructure here in roads that restores some money that had not been there before or cut through the sequester. What this does is says there's no money for high-speed rail, specifically targeted for high-speed rail. That has a much larger impact in places out west where there's been, you know, the state of California has been looking at doing some large high-speed rail projects and things like that. In Michigan, what I'm told is that the line that runs from Detroit to Chicago could be impacted in terms of what they look for in the future, but right now they weren't looking for additional money anyway. So as it stands, that might be sort of a zero-sum game for Michigan at the moment. But as that line gets going, there, you know, could be a need for funding. In the future, there might be funding available from other sources at some point.
Okay.
And by the way, I wanted to mention they didn't fool around with this for very long at all. I mean, this came out. They got the votes. This has already gone to the president. I mean, it's done. And they were able to really push this through quickly with really very little consternation, especially considering the fact that you had some real conservative groups, Heritage and the Club for Growth, telling conservatives not to vote for this. It got done. This is not going to be an issue going forward to the midterms, it doesn't look like. So it shows that Congress can get stuff done when it really wants to.
But do you think that's because Election Day 2014 is hanging over their heads like the sword of Damocles, and everybody was so the electorate was furious last fall?
Yeah, what I honestly believe in terms of that is that there were a lot of members of the Republican Party here in Congress who were not happy at all with the shutdown. I mean, some of them went along with it because there were more conservative members who were really pushing this. But I think pretty clearly from some comments, like those comments from Mike Rogers, from Michigan, you know, who said that this was a mistake. This was something that really we're never going to win this. We're turning ourselves into the bad guys. We need to keep pushing for cuts where we can get them and not shut government down to do it. And ultimately, I think the experience of the shutdown, how it turned on them, really played out. And I think the more moderate, not, I shouldn't say moderate, but the people who want to keep government open and think that there has to be some kind of compromise are right now ascendant, and they're going to push for this as hard as they can. They think they're going to be hurt if government were to get shut down again. So now they've made sure it's not going to, at least not this year.
They're in the driver's seat at this point. But you got to wonder, so this deal lasts until September, right, this new budget?
Right.
What do you foresee as the next congressional mud wrestling match? Will it come up to next fall with a new budget, or is there going to be something new that's going to cause them to go back in the mud pits?
It will. I mean, there's another debt ceiling increase that's going to come up. There's clearly going to be somewhat of a fight about that. They're always going to find something to fight over. Right now, we have some important provisions under the Farm Bill, which we haven't had for years now, and sort of just been banging along. They need to sort that out, or milk prices could spike here in the very near future. They'll probably work something out on that. But in terms of this budget, it'll go to next September. Believe me, it'll be next September before anything gets worked out. They don't work anything out until the last minute, until they absolutely have to.
The old feet to the fire thing.
Right.
Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much, Todd.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From Motown to Madonna, techno to gospel, jazz and blues, from Eminem to Kid Rock to Aretha and so much more, the Detroit area has been and continues to be a music powerhouse. In fact, at least 38 Grammy Award winners and nominees over the past 5 years have a Metro Detroit connection. A recent study from the Anderson Economic Group takes a deep dive into the business of the Detroit area music scene. We're joined now by the principal author of this study. He's Director of Public Policy and Economic Analysis for the Anderson Economic Group. Welcome to Alex Rosen.
Thank you.
So your study found that the Metro Detroit area is home to 486 music-related businesses, plus over 400 restaurants and bars and parks and other performance spaces. And when I see that generated $1.2 billion in sales revenue, I was floored. Did that surprise you as it surprised some of us?
Well, seeing a number as large as $1 billion in revenue was certainly an eye-opener. I didn't really go in knowing what to expect because, again, a lot of music activity is happening behind the scenes or under the table, and we didn't know what would show up in the data and what wouldn't. But we were pleasantly surprised to see that it really is making its mark.
And how many workers, roughly, are part of this? And I'm sure it's a little bit hard to corral all of that, but give us an idea.
Yeah. At least 7,000 people contributed to the industry, and that doesn't count some people who probably should. There are maybe some people who book the music at a restaurant, and it does count some people who maybe work at a venue that hosts both music and also the circus, a big venue like that. But it's certainly in the thousands, probably closer to 10,000 than 5,000.
So when we look at the $1.2 billion and the 7,000 some people working in the business, how does that compare with other major cities? I'm kind of curious. How does Detroit fit in?
Well, when you're making comparisons, you have to make a decision about how you're looking at it.
Right.
We compared to Detroit to a lot of our peers, where people often make economic comparisons. Our economy is often compared to Minneapolis and Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And when you look at what people think of as our economic peers, we do pretty well. We have, if you look at the music business as a share of total employment, we're certainly on the higher end of that spectrum, considerably more than Indianapolis's and Cleveland's and Kansas City's of the world. We didn't make the comparison to the kind of worldwide benchmark music cities of Nashville and Los Angeles and Austin. We just went a different direction with the study.
It is kind of surprising to me that these music businesses and people generated that much revenue when there's really no music area in Detroit. I mean, I'm thinking of a couple of years ago when I was in Memphis walking along Beale Street. We don't have anything like that in the Detroit area. And it makes you wonder what kind of boost it could give if people had an area where they knew where to go to hear Detroit area music.
Yeah, in that respect, I think the story of Detroit music is a lot about, like the story of the rest of the Detroit economy, very spread out across a big region. People are surprised to see the Detroit area among the top population metro areas because they think about the city of Detroit. But when you look at this 5-county region, we really do have a lot going on, and it's just very spread out. And you're absolutely right that having a concentration of activity in different sectors really helps a lot in a lot of different areas, hotels, retail establishments, and businesses like that really do better when there are more of them. They just you attract more people. I'm talking to you right now from Michigan Avenue in Chicago, where there's just this great conglomeration of retail establishments, and people fly in from Japan to come here and stay in the hotels. I think the same goes for the music industry, and your observation about having something like where you walked in Nashville would really help.
I'm speaking with Alex Rosane, who is with the Anderson Economic Group and the principal author of a fascinating new study looking at the business of the Detroit area music scene. It's called Music Industry in Detroit, Estimating the Size of the Music Industry in the Motor City. Alex, do you think Detroit's music industry has been overlooked in the many conversations that have been held about how to revitalize the city? Could they be contributing more and asked to do more?
I think that it is definitely one of the tools in our toolbox. It's probably not going to be a big driver in terms of getting everybody back to work, but it makes more of a contribution than you think, as we showed in our study.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps in another way, too. Having culture like this and having just a lot going on, having a scene, it makes every other industry more able to attract workers and retain workers, and it's a quality of life issue as well as an economic driver. It's not going to replace a bunch of auto plants closing, but it makes its mark and contributes in other ways too.
You know, it's kind of interesting to think of the juxtaposition of this music-related business in Detroit generating, as you found, $1.2 billion in sales revenue, but so many of the folks working that business are living hand-to-mouth. I mean, they're making art, but they aren't making money, are they?
That's right. For a lot of people, it's a job, and for other people, it's a labor of love, and they make their money otherwise. It's and everywhere in between. It's one of those things where sometimes the pay you get is getting to do it at all. In front of people, but nevertheless, there is a lot of money changing hands. There are businesses that provide the artists with the place to, the venue to play, the music publishing and instrument manufacturing and so forth. There's just a lot of places that this touches. Of course, the impact that music has on our society as a whole is even greater than this, because people doing it privately or in church or for fun or to let off steam. So it really, again, makes its mark in a lot of different ways.
What do you think political or community leaders in Michigan should take away from your report, or could take away from your report?
I think that they could think about how even artistic endeavors can have a business aspect to them. They can attract people from outside the region, and again, they contribute to quality of life. So just making sure we have... don't have any barriers to a healthy sector here, and building on a tradition is an opportunity that we have that other places don't have. Even places that have a similarly sized music industry, they don't have the story to tell. We sort of have a foundation laid here that we could build from because of our history that, say, a Dallas, Texas might not.
Sure, sure. A very interesting study entitled The Music Industry in Detroit, Estimating the Size of the Music Industry in the Motor City. And we've been talking with the principal author, Alex Rosane of the Anderson Economic Group. Alex, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Stop and think for just a moment of the many, many ways we capture moments of our lives and then share them with everyone. Snap a photo on your smartphone, and in seconds, you can have it up on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram for friends, family, and followers to see. But here's a question. What will happen to those moments in your memories someday in the future when Instagram or Tumblr or Facebook or Flickr no longer exist? We need to preserve the images and ties to our past for those who want to know about us in the future. How best do we do that in this digital age? For advice, we get to pick the brain of someone who does this for a living. Michael Shallcross is the assistant archivist in the Division of Digital Curation. He's with the University of Michigan's Bentley Historical Library. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's quite a mouthful, your title, but give us, first of all, for those who aren't familiar with the Bentley Library, What's its mission and how long has it been around?
Certainly. The Bentley Historical Library was established in 1935, and its mission is to serve as the official archives of the University of Michigan and also to document the activities of individuals and organizations and voluntary associations across the state of Michigan. And our goal is to establish procedures, strategies, and resources for the library to preserve and manage born digital records, that is, office documents, PDFs, photographs, video, as well as digitized materials.
Give us an idea of when you say digitized materials. What does that mean?
Digitized materials are when we scan images or documents, or we convert cassette tapes or reel-to-reel tapes to a digital format.
Okay.
And we part of our mission in preserving born digital is also to archive websites, which we do at the University of Michigan and across the state.
And can you compare and contrast what you do when you curate and preserve digital information versus the traditional, the hard copies, the documents, photos, the audio and videotapes from the past? What are the advantages of archiving digital information and what are the special challenges?
In some ways, we employ the same principles and practices. We try to maintain the original order of things so that, you know, there's a certain value inherent to the way a producer or record producer manages their own records. But at the same time, digital content has a host of challenges. On the one hand, we have to deal with format obsolescence. The file formats that we store content in, if they are no longer supported by software or hardware, they are no longer accessible.
Case in point, anybody that had family memories on those old beta tapes.
Exactly.
When beta lost to VHS. Or if you've got them on your VHS tapes, talk about obsolescence.
Or if you have WordPerfect formats, WordPerfect word processing documents. So that's one challenge. I guess the other challenge is that in some ways this information is rather ephemeral. You know, it is just stored zeros and ones on some piece of media. And if that, and that media can be a floppy disk, it can be an optical disk such as a CD or DVD, it could be a USB flash drive, or, you know, the hard drive on your computer. And if, anything happens to that storage media, then voila, your information is gone.
You don't even have the version of the shoebox in the basement with the old photographs to fall back on. You have nothing.
Exactly. And, you know, in some respects, you know, high-quality paper will last hundreds and hundreds of years. Meanwhile, you know, a CD might have a lifespan of, you know, 5 to 10 years.
So when we talk about saving digital material, give us an example, if you can, Mike, as far as how someone was thrilled to get material that they perhaps thought was lost forever.
Certainly. Just the other day in our reading room at the Bentley Library, a researcher was interested in finding out about the visits of U.S. presidents to the University of Michigan. The university had previously had this information on a website, but the site has since been taken down. Fortunately, we have actually archived that site as part of our University of Michigan Web Archives, and so we were able to provide the researcher with an earlier version of the website, and then they were able to find the information they needed.
So for those of us, like, we have a website we're very proud of here at Michigan Radio. It gets created, and then, you know, you move on and keep refreshing it. And I think in a lot of our minds, we think it's gone, it's done, but that's not the case.
We can turn back the clock with our web archives.
How so?
Well, essentially, we take snapshots of websites on an annual basis. We currently are preserving over 800 unique University of Michigan websites and close to 200 websites of individuals and organizations from across the state. And essentially, with web archiving, we preserve a mere copy of that website as it existed at a moment in time. And we're able to view earlier versions of these sites. You can do full-text search in them. And essentially experience the website as it existed in an earlier period of time.
So I know you were mentioning you got a Michigan Radio website right from the beginning back in 2010.
Indeed.
So the idea that, well, that doesn't seem so long now ago, but in a few years down the road, that really will be, that'll be like opening up a Detroit Free Press from 1875.
That's the idea. And, perhaps that in these archive websites might not be of super research value now, but, you know, we're thinking ahead 5 years, 10 years down the line, when perhaps the web as we know it has completely changed and these cultural artifacts will let people see how we live today.
I'm speaking with Mike Shellcross, who's the assistant archivist in the Division of Digital Curation at the University of Michigan's Bentley Historical Library. So you do this for a living. What advice do you have for those of us who use all these social media sites? It's Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram and Facebook. How do we preserve our user-created content?
Great question. I think there are a couple very simple steps that we can follow. I think in the first hand, always read the small print. You want to make sure that when you put information online into one of these sites that you're going to be able to get it back out. Also, you want to make sure that you still – do you really own that information when it's posted online? I think there have been examples where Facebook and other social media sites kind of lay claim to the material that is user-supplied, and it's also used as part of their business. So I think it's important to understand kind of what it means when you post content online.
It's their play. It's their sandbox. It's people complain about things Facebook does, and I'm like, hey, it's Mark Zuckerberg's sandbox. They can do what they want.
Exactly.
We need to accept that.
And I think you also want to make sure that you can get – if you put content on there, you can get it back out. Are there, you know, methods for you to download or export content out of those systems? I think another important point, and this applies for social media as well as, you know, things on your own personal computer, is always back up. Lots of copies keep stuff safe. And if you only have one copy, that's a single point of failure. And if that's gone, you're going to lose, you know, very important, you know, records or family mementos. I think a third point is to try to adhere to standards. You know, if you're going to save something in a file format, use a format that is widely used. If possible, that's open, where it's not proprietary or tied to a single piece of software or hardware. Because if you use open standards and open formats, that increases the possibility that it can be reused on other platforms and other systems, and that you will have access to that content, you know, for, you know, hopefully a very long period of time.
Mike, do you trust the cloud?
I think used appropriately, the cloud can be a great resource.
Okay.
But you never want to put all your eggs in one basket. The cloud can be part of an overall strategy of preserving your digital records. So have one copy in the cloud, have another copy on your personal computer, have a third copy and an external hard drive. And of course, you always want to be refreshing, you know, your hard drive or your personal computer. But definitely the cloud, some serious examples of data being lost in cloud. I think Amazon had a situation where a bunch of data disappeared from its servers. There have been cases with Google. Okay. These things will happen. But if you take steps, if you back up your data and don't just rely on that one storage environment, then you'll hopefully avoid, you know, any significant data loss.
You are echoing the cry that I have heard over the years from the tech people, back it up, back it up, back it up. Mm. And I bet that's probably where a lot of us fall down.
Indeed. I think another important thing, though, is also add metadata. If you take pictures on your with your camera, save them to your computer, you know, a year, 2 years, 5 years, you might not know just where you took those photos, who's in them, what the event was. So it's always great to at least, you know, in the folder names for your things, you know, include a little information. Or if possible, you know, you could even have a simple text file that listed, you know, who was at the event, when it was, what happened. That kind of metadata really improves your ability to search for and reuse information in the future.
You're echoing what my late aunt, who was kind of our family's archivist, self-appointed, would always say, always write something on the back of that photo, because she was wallowing through photos from the 19th century and early 20th century, and you look at that face and go, who is that?
Mm.
So you're absolutely right. I'm hearing what you're saying, and it makes me realize I have some work to do. Mike Shallcross is the assistant archivist in the Division of Digital Curation at the University of Michigan's Bentley Historical Library. And, of course, you can go to their website and just kind of find a treasure trove of things that you can look through and kind of experience the past. And what is that website?
Indeed. It's bentley.umich.edu.
Mike, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder delivered his fourth State of the State address Thursday night. The Republican governor called Michigan the comeback state and talked up the economy, saying Michigan has come a long way from the dark days of the Great Recession. Not surprisingly, though, Democrats didn't quite agree, highlighting cuts to education spending and the state's earned income tax credit. Let's take a deeper dive into the speech now with Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Welcome, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome back to the program Chris Gouts, who's Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Hey, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So many political pundits said this speech felt kind of like a report card, with the governor taking a look back at the last 3 years that he's been in office and highlighting his accomplishments. Chad, is that a fair analysis?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is the time to do it. He is facing re-election this year, although he hasn't officially announced. All signs point that he will ask the voters for a second term, so this is a good time to to give an address talking about all the great things that he believes he's done for the state since he took office.
And Chris, did you think a lot of that was simply because this was an election year, that if it was not an election year, we might have heard a different thrust?
No, I don't think so. You know, when the governor came, you know, when he started, you know, his whole thing in that very first State of the State address, you know, he said, this is not going to be a cheerleading rah-rah type of speech for me, you know, during my term. You're going to hear a report card. I'm going to lay out, you know, this first year, we're going to decide what metrics we're going to measure. And then each year I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to tell you exactly what we did good on and what we still need to work on. And so I think from that perspective, I think, you know, it was kind of more of the same. But like Chad said, this is an election year. And so he was talking about the things that they've done the last 3 years and to try to set the stage for, you know, for the fall and in the coming fight. Because while he hasn't announced, you know, this was his fourth State of the State address, but I don't think it was a surprise to anyone that he hopes and plans next January to be giving his fifth State of the State address.
You know, in the few days since the speech, there has been some debate about what Governor Snyder said about education spending. Now, in his speech, he said funding has increased $660 per student under his administration. But Democrats pretty quickly cried foul over this number. So, Chad, what's going on here?
Well, to quote Tim Grimmel, the House Democratic leader, you have to go through some, quote, fiscal gymnastics to arrive at that number. You have to back out the amount of money that was in the per pupil funding prior to Governor Snyder taking office that came from the 2009 federal stimulus law that essentially helped bail out schools and helped keep teachers employed a couple more years longer during the recession. So that money went away, and then the governor started increasing the funds. And then also you have to add into that number, almost half of it is actually money that the school districts aren't getting directly. Their bills are being paid for them for teacher and school employee pensions. So that's one of the complaints among the school lobby is like, look, you know, our per pupil money isn't going up like they're saying it is. That's true. Their foundation grant hasn't gone up as much, but they're getting, instead of the money going to them and them paying pension fund, the state is just essentially cutting out the middleman transfer, so to speak, and paying the bill.
Is this one of those cases, Chris, where politicians are using numbers in the equations that work best for their message, that kind of depending on how you do the math and what you count and what you don't, it can really change what the real answer is?
Well, sure. I mean, that's what politicians do. I mean, and this is probably the issue that's going to be the most confusing for voters, because they're going to hear things from both sides that are going to sound right factually. From most, I would say most times, that both sides are going to be right. It's one of those weird issues where you can really lay out the numbers and be factually correct on both sides. And so it's going to be incredibly difficult for voters. I think the key is going to lie not in the overall message, but in the individual circumstance. And so if your school has a larger class size and your school lost it, some of its extracurricular things, or it lost its librarian, or it lost its art class, that's where you're going to feel it, and you're going to have a different perspective as opposed to, you know, the millions of dollars that are going to be spent trying to win over the argument of whether or not Governor Snyder and Republicans have cut education funding or if they have, you know, put more into it.
Can we assume that we're going to hear a lot about education funding as the race for governor heats up?
Oh, sure. And if average voters think it's confusing, journalists think it's confusing too. I mean, there's no subject where funding gets more murky than schools. Almost every school has a different number based on a whole host of equations on property tax and other tax revenues. And one example is in Livonia schools, their per pupil foundation grant went up $5 last year. But the legislature and the governor cut a grant that they created in 2011 to encourage so-called best practices in their management, consolidation of services. And by cutting that grant in this budget cycle, they lost $47 per student. So they're actually down negative 42. So it is, like Chris said, it's going to vary district by district about the real true fiscal impact on schools.
That was Chad Livengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, and he's joined by Chris Gouts, Capital correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, as we deconstruct the fourth State of the State address from Governor Snyder this past Thursday night. Let's shift over to transportation, and we heard the governor again pushing for a fix to the state's roads and crumbling infrastructure. Now, we know in the past the governor said he wants that additional $1.2 billion annually for fixes. What did the governor have to say about that in this address? It seemed kind of light on ways to pay for what he wants, Chris.
Yeah, it sure did. It was one of a host of issues where he didn't really spend any time at all talking about things, and transportation was definitely one of them. It was not the major push that he gave in 2013 for transportation. And so what he did talk about was, the $250 million that's going to go more this year, which to sort of a general audience that might listen to the State of the State address, and that's all they really, pay attention to politics, at this time of the year, that sounds like a big number. But as the MDOT director said, you spread that out over the thousands and thousands of miles that MDOT has to maintain, it's really just a drop in the bucket.
Was some of that just the fact that he got nowhere with the proposal he made for that $1.2 billion a year ago? So was he just kind of saying, okay, ball in your court, legislature?
Yeah, I think a little bit of that. He continues to put it back in their lap, and he also just learned a lesson. If you throw out a huge number, they may not come through for you. He did drop hints that, and he has continued to drop hints that some of this stimulus or the surplus, this roughly $971 million over 3 years, that he wants to put some of that sort of one-time money into road projects. So I think you will probably see that come out in his budget address on the 5th of February.
Let's talk about some of the new proposals we heard about, beginning with immigration. And we've heard this governor calling himself one of the most pro-immigration governors in America. And with that, he called for the creation of the Office for New Americans. What will this office do, Chris?
Well, that's a good question. And we've been trying to get some more details out of the governor's office, and I haven't had great success yet. But basically, he had the MEDC and the Department of Civil Rights last year really look at, every way in which the federal immigration system touches the state of Michigan. And it's many different, ways. And so they came up with this report, and they decided that they wanted to create this new office, which will sort of be a clearinghouse for when there are issues. But it sounds like it's going to be more of an advocacy type office where they're going to hear about issues and they could take those to maybe the congressional delegation or have that at the ready if the governor goes to Washington or if he wants to really push this, because it is at the end of the day a federal issue. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some things that he wants to do, and I think just having the office itself is sort of a positive in his mind, because he's trying to make the case that Michigan is welcome to immigrants, but he really has to spend the time to make the case to the general public what he's talking about in terms of these well-educated immigrants that are being, that are learning engineering at U of M and Michigan State, and then they have to leave once they graduate. He's trying to make the case for that and get people away from thinking about immigration as just people coming over the border in Texas and, in Arizona, and get that out of their minds. And so I think part of that is what he hopes this new office is going to do.
Kind of change the parameters of the conversation. But Chad, how is this sitting with Snyder's fellow Republicans as far as you can tell?
They haven't really made much comment on it. I mean, they probably are going to defer to him that he knows a little more about this as far as his overall agenda in attracting better talent to the state than some of them. But he also has made it another way he's kind of framed it is this could be a way to repopulate Detroit in some ways, try to get more immigrants legally entering the country to consider moving to Detroit. He's kind of been dropping that hint in the last couple of days. And so there may be a larger strategy here at work that hasn't quite unfolded.
Mm. Now let's go back to education, because that is such an overwhelmingly important topic to so many in Michigan. It was a big theme. And this year, like he did in the last State of the State address, he called for another big investment in early childhood education, recommending an additional $65 million to eliminate that waiting list for low-income children who want to get into preschool. Chris, do you think this additional money is going to get past the legislature?
Oh, absolutely. And I'd be surprised if there was a single vote against it. It's pretty hard to vote against something like this. It sounds really good, and it is a really good thing. And Democrats see it as a positive, too. One negative that they had about it was the way it was funded this year, and they say taking money for out of K-12 and taking for that $65 million to apply it to this program. Gretchen Whitmer, the Senate Minority Leader, was making the case after the State of the State address that if he was really serious about making a true investment, it would be $65 million new dollars, not just taking it from one pot of overall education money and putting it to this, but really making a separate investment.
On Thursday night, I thought one of the biggest, most lively rounds of applause came when the governor called on lawmakers to pass a resolution urging Congress to pass a balanced budget amendment that would basically amend the U.S. Constitution and force the federal government to balance its budget. What's behind this? Why is he pushing for this?
Well, we're not really sure about that either, to be honest. That was kind of, you know, maybe as one person said, out in right field. It didn't fit with this governor. And I kind of questioned, you know, he routinely says, you know, when he gets asked about something Washington's doing, he says, look, I just like to stay in my lane and I stick to, you know, governing the state of Michigan. So that seemed like way outside of Rick Snyder's normal lane. But it got a huge applause from his Republican colleagues. And some people around the country kind of took notice of that, which that might have been why he was doing that.
Chris, I know some Democrats have said this is just politics and that Snyder's trying to score political points here.
That was the that was the immediate reaction. And to some extent, you know, that's, you know, what we hear around the country when this is brought up. But I mean, it's something that sounds pretty easy to grasp. And so I think the problem for Democrats is going to be if they're really going to make this sort of an issue that this is just an example of the governor being extreme or pandering to the right wing, they're going to really have to explain to people why they think it's wrong to have a balanced budget. I mean, most people that, you know, balance their checkbooks, they would understand that you need to have an imbalance. And so obviously, if they really want to make this an issue, that they really need to make sure that they're not on the losing side of an argument that from some people, unless they really understand it, really take the time to look at the nuance of it, to think, well, shouldn't that be obvious? Like, shouldn't everyone be balancing have a balanced budget?
Right.
Let's talk about Detroit for the little bit of time we have left. I think a lot of people were expecting to hear more, considering everything that has happened in the past year in Detroit. But there wasn't too much meat in that address about Detroit. Did you think? And I'll ask you that first, Chad, as a Detroit news writer.
Yeah, I mean, the governor has spent a lot of time and political capital in the last year installing an emergency manager in Detroit, authorizing the bankruptcy, showing up in court himself, and testifying unusual, unprecedented event, and yet he spent a very passing moment about on Detroit and said he didn't want to dwell on it. There's been some criticism that he could have taken a better opportunity here to sort of level with Michiganians about the reality of Detroit's bankruptcy, maybe without even getting into this idea that he has floated around to legislators to put money into a fund that would help shore up the pensions and be part of a global settlement to try to settle the bankruptcy as quick as possible.
Chris, last word, anything you wanted to add on what we didn't hear about Detroit?
Well, I think there were a number of things. In terms of, like you said, he didn't spend much time talking about Detroit. He spent all of 12 seconds talking about energy policy, which was just non-existent. He didn't talk about the DIA. He didn't talk about what to do about Detroit pension retirees. He didn't talk about no-fault insurance or the minimum wage or the L.A. Larson Civil Rights Act. But I think in terms of Detroit, I think people were hoping that he might say a little bit more. The State of the State is supposed to be a positive address. And so if you just leave out Detroit, I mean, is that sending sort of subliminal message that there isn't a positive story to tell there? I would think that the governor would obviously disagree with that. He spends so much time talking about everything positive that's going on in the city. But to give it such short shrift, I think made a lot of people question, you know, why that was.
That was Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and he was joined by Chad Liebengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. As always, great talking to you guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Remember the green clay character Gumby?
Gumby, I don't think your idea stands a ghost of a chance.
Come on, get into the spirit of things, Pokey.
Well, Gumby's got Michigan roots.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
There are so many products that seem to be known and used everywhere, but hidden away is the fact they're made in Michigan, or in this case, made by someone from Michigan. Beloved toy and TV and movie star Gumby was created by animator Art Clokey. His son, Joe Clokey, joins us to explain just how Michigan inspired his dad to come up with Gumby.
Well, he had great memories of being on his grandfather's farm there in Michigan, and the cars in the mud, when it rained, would get stuck in the gumbo, they would call it. That's Latin for clay, and that stuck with my dad. And later, when he was making clay characters, he came up with that name, and Gumby is the little boy, and Gumbo is the dad, and Gumba is the mom. So it came from that, what he learned in on that farm in Michigan. And Michigan meant a lot to my dad. If you look back in the very early Gumby episodes, there was a crane that said Michigan on it. It was the Michigan crane. You'd see that train swirling around and being used in many shots. So it's kind of a not so much subliminal, but just showing how much Michigan meant to him.
A nice homage to the Great Lakes State.
It was.
What inspired your dad to create Gumby in the first place?
He was working on a student film called Gumbasia. Gumbasia was clay animated to the beat of jazz music, and it blew the mind of president of 20th Century Fox. He said, "Art, I'd like to improve children's television. Can you make clay characters?" And my dad said, "Yeah, sure." And my dad went home and came up with the characters.
And there they are. And
yes.
And it's amazing to think you can find Gumby anywhere and is still beloved all these years later.
It is.
Joe Clokey. His father, Art Clokey, created Gumby, one of the most widely recognized characters in the world. Thanks for talking with us, Joe.
Thank you very much.
And as part of our Made in Michigan series, we want to hear from you. From snowboards to ballpark franks, what products do you know of that were invented right here? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook or tweet us at Stateside Radio, or find us on the website michiganradio.org and click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.